Hi, Will.
How are you this afternoon?
Very good, thank you.
It's a morning for me in Iowa City. You're in Israel. Let's just introduce ourselves. I'm Will Wilkinson at the Cato Institute, and you are Saul Smolansky at... Tell us where you're from, Saul.
I'm from the University of Haifa in Israel on top of Mount Carmel. And it's afternoon here, so I appreciate your waking up early just to talk with me.
Well, it's my pleasure. Saul, you are the author of a recent book called 10 Moral Paradoxes. I'm holding it up to the camera now. It's got a handsome black cover. It's kind of hard to read the title on the camera. And it's an unusual work. You do... somewhat unusual thing. So tell us a little bit about your specialty in philosophy.
Right. I do normative ethics, which is roughly the content of morality and getting things right. And I tend to do odd things. So I've worked on free will, and I've worked on 10 moral paradoxes, and now my next five-year plan is to work on an idea I have called the crazy ethics, which is connected to all my previous work. And all of that is pretty odd. I mean, it's not so much like, certainly not the Ten Commandments, but it's even not like Kant or something. It's maybe a combination of Immanuel Kant and the Monty Python or something. So
yeah.
it's pretty
well,
odd.
Well, that sounds pretty appealing. Michael Palin instead of Sarah Palin, maybe. I don't know if you...
Israelis keep neutral on American politics.
That's right. Well, tell us a little bit about your book. So tell us a little bit about what a paradox is, technically speaking, and then what's a moral paradox in particular.
Okay. Traditionally, paradoxes are, I guess, sort of arguments where you have an assumption which looks perfectly okay, and then you have an argument which you can't find any fault in, but the conclusion... just seems unacceptable. So we have a problem, and because the conclusion is unacceptable, traditionally the thing to do is to go back and check your premises or check your argumentation. Now this sometimes looks like antinomies. You just have two sets of arguments with opposite conclusions, but that's really the same thing. And in addition to that, I think some of my moral paradoxes are just like that. And they have this traditional form, but it's just about morality. In addition to that, I've thought about a different sort of paradox, which is also quite rigorous. I mean, we don't want to say that anything that's just unusual or ironic or surprising is a paradox, because that makes the whole concept useless. It's not really interesting to talk that way. But so I'm trying to stay rigorous in what I consider to be a paradox, but nevertheless, I think that at least in morality, it's an interesting question whether it goes beyond morality, but at least in morality, we have also paradoxes that have a different form, where, the assumptions are wonderful, the argumentation is kosher, but the assumptions are absurd, but nevertheless, the conclusion is absurd, but nevertheless, it's true. So we have... true conclusions that are absurd, and that means that the paradox is not some sort of mistake where we've got the premises wrong or the argumentation wrong, but no, the paradoxes actually are a discovery. The absurdity is the result we get about morality. So a certain corner of morality is simply absurd. I mean, of course, we need to have a fairly robust sense of what an absurdity is, but we can take that to be commonsensical.
Yeah, you have a notion that you call existential paradox, and I suppose the idea of existential paradox is to sort of distinguish between this view that every time you run up against a paradox, it's because either, you know, one of the premises in your argument is, you know, so there's something wrong with one of your sort of premises. You're saying that sometimes there's nothing wrong with your premises. They're all true. The conclusion actually follows. It's just the fact that the world is paradoxical.
Exactly.
Right?
I couldn't have said it better.
But this depends. So understanding the idea of what's paradoxical does, like as you're saying, depend a little bit on our idea or our grasp of what is and isn't absurd. Now, do you get the sense that people agree on, in general, on what an absurd conclusion is?
I think there there must be some cultural aspects here, but I hope that they'll be marginal. I mean, I hope that people will agree that most of the conclusions that I find absurd are indeed absurd, and if not, then they'll just not agree that there's a paradox here, and that's fine as well. But I think that some of the conclusions are so absurd that I think pretty much everybody will agree that they're absurd.
Well, it's easier to test by jumping into cases. So let's talk about one of the first ones in your book, which you call Fortunate Misfortune. And this one, I think, it does seem paradoxical to me and also familiar. So tell us a little bit about Fortunate Misfortune.
Okay. We're all familiar with this phrase, and it seems, I guess, to mean that something seemed like was an apparent misfortune, but then it turned out well. I think, first of all, it's important to distinguish between a true case of fortune and misfortune and just a blessing in disguise. I mean, if you break your leg and you end up in a hospital, and then you find the love of your life and meet the doctor and you marry her, then it was certainly worth it. And it's, I mean, breaking a leg is usually unpleasant, but it really is a blessing in disguise. It's nothing compared to finding the love of your life.
Right.
On the other hand, the cases that I consider to be fortunate misfortunes are cases where clearly what went wrong in the beginning is much more significant. And we might just take an example. I mean, one of the cases I describe is a girl I called Abigail, who is born with significant breathing difficulties, and she also has trouble walking properly, and things seem pretty grim. But then luckily a doctor diagnoses her and says that the best thing to do would be for her to swim. And she takes up swimming with the encouragement of her parents and everybody else's help. And it's actually a struggle because there's no swimming pool nearby, but they manage. And she takes up swimming gradually in a very, very serious way and becomes, this is a Hollywood story. I mean, she becomes Olympic champion in swimming and has a wonderful life. And this is a crucial point here. She has a life that's better than the life she would have had she stayed on, I mean, for example, the life that her neighbors or relatives have in their small town where she started in. So it turns out that, and it's also important that she agrees to this, it turns out that her life now is significantly better than it would have been had she not been suffered the misfortune to begin with. Now, what are we going to do with this? On the one hand, it seems that clearly this was a misfortune, and either it's obvious that it was a misfortune, or if you think about it a little bit, we'll say things like, well, nobody would ever wish such a misfortune on his enemies, or at least most of your enemies, certainly not on one's child. Even if you knew that it was going to succeed later, you would never wish something like that on your child. And the fact that you managed to climb that very tall mountain and triumph in the end doesn't mean that there wasn't a mountain there. I mean, there wasn't a misfortune. Clearly, there was a misfortune. And the fact that we need so much good in order to compensate for the misfortune also indicates that there was a misfortune. So there's a strong case for saying that there was a misfortune. On the other hand, we want to say, well, how can it be a misfortune if it made her life better? And she actually agrees to it. I mean, again, it's crucial that she not say things like, well, I would give up everything I have now if only I could have had a happy childhood. No, she says that she agrees that her life now is better. But she still insists that with all the suffering and humiliation and pain and all the idea of being singled out, and you can imagine her crying at night because of the bad fortune, she will naturally insist it was.
The other kids make fun of her. She can't play. You know, it was miserable, right? You know.
Well, she can say that. Sorry.
Go ahead. I actually remember reading a little bit of literature in. I think I read it in Jonathan Haidt's book on happiness about gratitude toward misfortune.
Right.
So there are, you know, like there's a psychological literature on people who are grateful for having suffered a misfortune for just this kind of reason. And that sometimes people who have experienced bad things end up feeling better about their lives than people who have suffered no misfortune at all. Partly because their misfortune sort of casts into a positive light everything that they would otherwise take for granted. So the fact that you almost died can make you more grateful for your life. And being more grateful for the life that you have makes you just more satisfied with your life. And so in some ways, it seems like people are often feel fortunate that they suffered a near fatal accident.
Right, right.
Would that be a case of fortunate misfortune?
Yes, yeah, certainly. I think the most striking case that I've heard of is of that of Primo Levi, the Jewish Italian author, who experienced Auschwitz, as you know, and some horrible things that he's written about very eloquently. And at the end of his life, he actually said that, in some sense, he thinks that his life was better because of that experience. Now, if somebody can sort of subsume that sort of thing under the idea of fortune and misfortune and say that it was, in the end, in some sense, a good fortune, then, then perhaps anything can take that conclusion in any case.
Yeah. I wonder if we have a case in, I'm sorry to insist on talking about American politics with Israelis, but in some sense, it seems like John McCain's torture in Vietnam, at least in political terms, might be fortunate misfortune. At least it's political good fortune. If you the Republican convention was just full of images of John McCain's torture during the Vietnam War, and you get the sense that he wouldn't have much to run on without this sort of the sense of his heroism because of the intense suffering that he and even the films, the propaganda films that the Republican National Committee were running, gave the sense that John McCain has built a kind of character out of the crucible of his suffering.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's our good fortune politically that John McCain has was suffered at the hands of the Vietnamese communists.
Yes. Oh, I think that case we can consider that under fortune misfortune in some ways. I mean, of course, we would have to ask him what he thinks, but certainly mm-hmm. it must have built his character. On the other hand, I doubt. I mean, if we would want to go and say, tell him, well, actually, you were fortunate to fall in North Vietnamese hands for a number of years and be tortured, etc., then I think he might not be too happy about what we want to say. And I think that's one of the striking things about the case of fortune and misfortune, or at least some of the cases that I consider, that, I mean, go back to Abigail, for example. I think that if you think about this baby, this young girl, it really is, I mean, it seems like an obvious misfortune, and anybody in her situation which would not have triumphed would have been sunk by the huge waves that engulfed her, then we would clearly say that it was a misfortune. But then in her case, we seem to be, at least one side of the antinomy, one side of the paradox, wants to say, well, because you've triumphed over it through superhuman effort, then actually it wasn't a misfortune. It was good fortune. And that just seems cruel and not really convincing. But on the other hand, we do have that strong argument that it actually made her life better. Just to go back to the McCain thing, I mean, I think for me it's an indication of the force of the fortunate misfortune, the idea of that, and of the question how we need to interpret it, is that you can say the same thing perhaps, I don't know, but perhaps, I don't know enough about his life, but little that I've heard about Barack Obama is also, it seems that he's certainly encountered prejudice and hardship and some difficult things pretty early on in his life, and that I'm sure also hardened his character or made him more sympathetic, or I don't know, I don't want to get into details, but I don't know enough, but it certainly made him what he is today. And again, there's a question whether we want to say, but we certainly don't want to say that, well, prejudice is good fortune. We don't want to encourage people to be racist, for example, because that will turn up making a few people more fortunate. So the whole thing is really odd, and it's unclear what to do about it. It seems we're torn, if we think about it deeply, I think that we'll be torn one way and then another way, and the arguments go back and forth.
Yeah, it does seem genuinely paradoxical in that I think the right – I mean, I find myself not wanting to say that, no, it's not really a misfortune – all things considered, you do want to say it's still a misfortune, even though it ended up being good for you overall. So, I mean, you end up saying that it was just a fortunate misfortune, which on its face seems paradoxical. Actually, the one we were just talking about was reminding me of another paradox in your book. Maybe we could talk about that, which is the paradox of moral worth. Thinking about John McCain's suffering in the battlefield made me think of that. Tell us a little bit about the paradox involved in morality and moral worth, because this is one I feel like I confront a lot. The idea that maybe it would be better for us to be put in strained circumstances where our virtues can better shine through.
Okay. Well, let's think about very kind of a Mickey Mouse theory of morality. Basically, what we have is we have needs, suffering, grievous injustice, dictators that have to be struggled against, etc. And then on top of that, we have a level of moral demands. I mean, morality asks us to relieve the suffering and fight the dictators, etc. And then on top of that, we get moral worth. When people, against their self-interest and through a lot of sacrifices, do the right thing, do what morality asks them to do. Now, we can think about heroic situations, either the McCain example or, I don't know, non-Jews hiding Jews during the Holocaust in World War II at risk to themselves and their families, or people fighting the mafia, or coming up against dictators, or whichever example somebody finds salient. And the interesting thing about that is that the moral worth, the heights of moral worth, which are arguably also, I mean, this is where human beings this is like the pinnacle of human value in some sense, or at least a certain sort of human value that seems very impressive. But this all depends on the fact that bad things happen. I mean, it depends on the fact that you have diseases, so doctors have to risk their lives struggling against them and helping people. Or it depends on the fact that you have dictators, so we have to rise against the dictators, etc. But the task of morality is to fight against injustice, as against suffering and against dictators and whatever. So, in fact, morality is like one of those mythological animals that ends up eating its own tail. So if we have a situation where, I mean, think about Denmark or some really splendid country where there's no dictators and no suffering, very little suffering, et cetera, and things, a well-ordered society sort of place. Now, in that place, there's very little that one can do to achieve the heights of moral worth. Now, I don't want to say that people end up being like morally like cabbages, but there's something in there. I mean, there's it's very difficult to find an avenue where you can achieve the heights of moral worth. And you're certainly not, I mean, you can be a perfectly decent person without struggling against your government, for example, because your government is pretty decent. There's no real reason to struggle against it. And you can see where the argument is going. So what happens is that, and this is why I think that this is an example of a case where I call what they call the good absurd. The good thing, which is there's no suffering, there's few diseases, we've overcome most of the bad things in social life, is also absurd because we don't have, as a result of all the good that we've done, we don't have the heights of moral worth. And you can say, well, but that's absurd, but that doesn't mean that it's a mistake. I mean, it's illegitimate. It's clearly illegitimate. I mean, think about somebody whose life work has been fighting against polio, and then they find a cure for polio or vaccine against polio. He can't then turn around and say, well, maybe we should develop some new mutant of polio that we don't have a vaccine against, just so that I can keep my life project alive. I mean, clearly, such a person is.
Yeah, after we cure AIDS, we'll create like neo AIDS so that we can all band together and fight for a cure.
Yeah.
That would be absurd.
Right. So clearly.
You know, there's a couple examples of this that I think come up in sort of everyday moral conversation. One that's, one more mundane and one dramatic. The mundane version of it is, kids these days don't have to struggle for anything, they've got it too easy. They've gone soft, right? This kind of idea that when you're comfortable financially, emotionally, as a sort of a teen or young adult, and don't have to struggle in order to reach a certain level of economic security, then that kind of sort of weakens your character, or you know that the fight against a kind of deprivation builds a certain kind of work ethic that's admirable, and we've lost that work ethic because people just already have it so easy because the culture is so rich. I think that's a good example. I mean, it's a mundane example, but a good example of mm-hmm. is it really so bad that teenagers don't really have to work as checkout boys at the grocery store, you know, because their parents earn enough to, you know, just float them through college or whatever. No, I don't think it's bad, but you do lose whatever you get out of, you know, having to work as a teen. The more dramatic version, which I remember very clearly seeing in the run-up to the war in Iraq, was that without, you know, these big conflicts, without wars, we as a culture will lose our martial virtue, and that we'll grow soft and feminine, and we'll be unable to defend ourselves should the need arise. But again, you know, this is one of those things. Because of living in peace for decades, the idea that we've lost our martial virtue is a side effect of something great, that we're not constantly in conflict. And it does strike me as a kind of absurdity to say that we need to get into a war so that we can experience valor on the battlefield.
Right. Well, I don't know if I want to follow you with all the distance on this, but I mean, living in Israel, I mean, we have conscription here, and I did more than 3 years of compulsory
right.
army service, and that wasn't a great deal of fun. So I would be happy if we had some peace and we could have a little less need for army service here. The catch is, in general, I mean, you could have, to some extent, you could say, well, we need to challenge young people in certain circumstances, or for pragmatic reasons, we need to keep some things like people that are militarily aggressive or something, because who knows what will happen in the future. But with many things, like the sort of examples that I gave before, it's impossible. You can't, morally, you cannot justify the idea that we'll make things worse just so that people can achieve the height of moral value by struggling against it. I mean, you can't say, well, once every 10 years, let's elect a dictator and then let him do what he wants, and then we would have to struggle in order to topple him or something like that. Or again, the example, I don't want to repeat the example of the diseases or something. I mean, it's just morality just pushes in one way, and that way, which is, it's not a mistake, and that's the thing that makes it interesting. It's not a mistake that we end up with absurdity, but nevertheless, we end up with absurdity because we eradicate the conditions which only they can allow us to reach the heights of moral worth. But morality, is obliged to lead in that direction. I mean, in terms of morality, we must try to eradicate diseases again, fight the dictators, limit injustice mm-hmm. To the extent that we can.
Yeah, well, I find that one fascinating because I think I agree with it, that morally, we are required to try to abolish the conditions under which people can achieve the heights of moral worth.
Right.
And that does seem paradoxical.
Right.
Let's move on to
an existential, I mean, that is an existential paradox, because it's not like we're making some mistake. We haven't figured out, but once we think things through, we'll see that we've made a mistake, and actually we can just start wars just to make people more courageous, or because the suffering will somehow make people more sympathetic to others. Something like that. I mean, that's clearly morally monstrous and unacceptable. So it's an existential paradox. It's just there. The absurdity, once you admit that there's absurdity here, you see that morally we can't escape it.
Mm-hmm. That's right. I'm kind of persuaded. I mean, part of that, I mean, I wonder to what extent the absurdity of that has to do with the sort of historical contingency of virtue, that what counts as a virtue in one era or in one place depends on the local social conditions. It depends on the problems that people are facing and need to overcome. And so, I mean, I think this has something to do with our sort of differences about the importance of martial virtue. If you live in Israel and you feel sort of besieged and under threat, surrounded by people who would like to destroy you, the idea that a certain kind of sort of martial virtue is going to be extremely plausible. You're not going to want to get rid of it. But if you're in a place like the United States, which is a huge country that nobody's going to attack, that can easily defend itself, the idea that we need martial virtue specifically to sort of maintain our liberties against outside aggressors really is kind of silly. It's kind of we passed that point. And so what seems morally worthy in one time or place can be different than what seems morally worthy in another time or place. So the paradox might arise because sort of history has moved past our old virtues, but there's a kind of path dependency in our sense of what the virtues are. And so it seems like that we now live in a culture that doesn't give us the opportunity to exercise these virtues. But that's actually a function of moral progress, and we're just wrong to see those virtues or whatever we think of as morally worthy as really morally worthy. It's not really morally worthy anymore. The conditions under which it was morally worthy have gone. Does that seem plausible, like a plausible way of dealing with the paradox?
I think to some extent, and with certain examples, I think that might work. But I would want to, more broadly, I would want to resist it. I mean, I think that in the more interesting cases, we would have fairly permanent situations. I mean, everybody who looks at people who struggle against dictatorship or struggle against the mafia or doctors risking their lives against diseases or whatever it might be. Everybody who looks at those sort of examples will think that these are amazing people and that it makes us look differently at life, that there are such people around and we're privileged to have them, and that we're certainly not sure that we would be ready to risk our lives for those causes, but we certainly admire the people who want to do this, are willing to do this. And I don't think that in such situations it's really culturally dependent. And I mean, I think perhaps there are studies about this, but I imagine that pretty much anybody that you ask will say that you'll have that wow feeling. But I agree that in some cases, like the military virtue ones, it might be more up for dispute.
Well, let's move on to a different paradox. I don't know how old you are, Saul. I get the sense that you're not a really old guy, but should you retire?
Right.
Are you should you quit your job and make room for someone else? Tell us about the paradox of beneficial retirement.
That ad hominem thing is a bit too close to home. Okay. Well, there's a paradox I call the paradox of beneficial retirement. And again, let's think about a doctor, a medical doctor. We might make it even more dramatic, a surgeon. And he works in a hospital and something in a large town, solid city. And he's not that bad. I mean, he's okay. I mean, if he's ill and he doesn't come to work, then that's a problem. There's one less surgeon around. But he's also not very good. I mean, let's say that he's on the 88th percentile from the top. So that he's better than 20% of the people, but worse than 80% of his colleagues, similar sort of surgeons. And the question is, what should he do about this? Normally, people don't do anything. I don't think hardly anybody has thought about this. But I actually think that there's a really serious problem here, and indeed a paradox. And I think, on the one hand, I think that there's a strong case for saying that he should retire. Now, it's clear, I want to clarify, that this is not a utilitarian argument. This is not one of those arguments that say that you should sell your car and donate the money to an orphanage in Africa or something like that. This is about integrity, and this is about your individual integrity. And arguably, I think that there's a problem about his integrity in the sense that it's either his integrity or his job. Because, I mean, clearly, if the reason why he's a doctor is because he likes wearing a white coat and he makes a lot of money and he also enjoys cutting people up, then that's fine. I mean, he doesn't fall into my claws. The paradox doesn't apply. But hopefully you'll have more kind of better motivations, at least with some of the surgeons. And if the reason why, or at least a major reason why he is a doctor, is that because he thinks that it's better if people live or die, and he wants to, he thinks it's important, health is important, and he wants to make people healthier, then our immediate response will be, well, in that case, you should just leave. I mean, retire. Because if there's somebody better than you, I mean, we're assuming that there's a pool outside of either new immigrants or recent graduates of medical schools. I mean, we're on the assumption that there are people who are better than him, because he's certainly below average. There's a pool of people who are better than him, and one of them would is very likely to replace him were he to leave, then arguably he can't maintain his integrity and stay on his job. That's a radical, a very radical conclusion. On the other hand, it also seems pretty crazy. I mean, normally we don't normally we don't ask of people to normally we don't ask of people to make that sort of sacrifice, except in very extreme conditions. I mean, like you were talking about war, perhaps. But normally, I mean, if we give this guy a choice, you can give us 20% of your post-tax income, or you can stay on in your job, he would certainly say, yes, I want to stay on, because he wanted to be a doctor since he was four, and this is his life work, and his, you know, his parents are really proud of him because he's a doctor, and there's no reason for him, except my argument, the argument of integrity, for leaving. He's really happy. That's his life. He wants to continue being a doctor. So it seems absurd to ask him to retire. On the other hand, how can he not retire and maintain his integrity? So that's basically the paradox.
Yeah. Well, the I mean, like, it's interesting because it's I mean, our attitude is actually sort of the opposite of that. Like, I mean, I want to talk to you about the sort of like the economics of this kind of question in a second. But the area where that's most familiar to me about this is in academia itself. So, you know, and this problem becomes a problem when there's a kind of a very protected pool of people who are incumbents, right? That their productivity is not the criterion according to which they get or keep their job. Maybe the way they got their job, but not the way they keep it. So when you're a tenured professor, you can sit around basically doing nothing, absorbing a very big paycheck. You could be paying maybe two or three entry-level professors for what you're paying for, you know, a 70-year-old full professor. And everybody who's been in graduate school had somebody like that in their department, right? Some older guy who just won't give up, despite the fact that he has no idea what's going on in his field anymore, just isn't really very good, is really just taking up space. But people's attitude, I mean, grad students will grumble for sure because those people are keeping them from getting jobs when they get in the job market. But there's a sense that we defer to those people, that part of what it means to respect them is to sort of allow them to keep, you know, doddering around doing what they're doing. But whereas what you're saying is that if they were to respect themselves, they would just quit.
Yes.
You know, knowing that they weren't doing anybody any good anymore, or somebody else would do much more good than they would that they're doing, that they should just quit. So, would we actually be respecting these, you know, Deadwood professors better by sort of pushing them out, by sort of forcing them to face up with, you know, to do what would be in their own interest in terms of their own integrity?
Right. Well, I think that you can ask the question on the social level. I mean, should we have tenure or should we encourage people to retire, et cetera? And I don't know. I mean, I'm sure you know much more about the economics of this than I do. I was just struck by this ethical argument that seems to me that nobody has ever made, at least in print, and that seemed to me quite powerful but also ridiculous in some ways. So, of course, I was attracted to it. And it's the argument by integrity. Now, because it's about integrity, it's not about maximizing the good, it seems to me a much stronger argument, because it's really difficult to say, well, I don't really care about my integrity. I mean, it's your integrity. You should really care about it. And because it's an argument about integrity, it also has this feature that it really doesn't matter what other people do. So unlike in many other social contexts, here, I mean, go back to our doctor, 20% of the other surgeons are actually worse than him. And let's assume that they won't retire. So he'll be the only one. I mean, he'll be a sucker. Nevertheless, because it's an argument about integrity, it seems there's a strong case that for saying that it seems that he really should retire, because otherwise, how can he maintain his integrity? It turns out to be a really strong argument. Now, it's interesting because
I don't know. I mean, like, if he's committed to helping people, to making sure that people, you know, are better off, that they're healthier, that they live rather than die. If he's in the 45th percentile, and he drops out, but nobody else does, that changes the quality of the pool of doctors, not at all, really. It seems like what you've got here is a collective action problem where, in order for it to be a matter of integrity for what, I mean, if what I'm trying to do as a matter of integrity is to make sure that people are better off, it seems like I need to coordinate with all the other bad doctors and have us quit en masse as a matter of integrity.
I don't think so. I mean, why would that?
No?
I think if as long as you're, let's assume that doctors, replacement doctors are assigned randomly. As long as you're on the bottom 50%, I mean, a little bit below that, then there's a greater chance that your replacement will be better than you than it will be worse than you. And in fact, because we know that the replacements will be, I mean, in a meritocracy, we know that first the best graduate students will get chances, etc. There's actually a very good chance that if you're even if you're above average, like a bit above average, there's a very good chance that your replacement will be better than you. But I don't even need to think about the top 50%.
Yeah.
As long as my argument applies to the bottom 50%, it's a huge argument. I mean, it's the paradox is applies to each individual, but if it has those social implications, I mean, if it applies to each one of those people, then it, you know, it's pretty shocking to think about it that way. I mean, half the doctors should consider retiring.
Yeah, I agree. You're right, given your assumptions about there being a pool of people, off in the wings. But one thing I wanted to mention is one of the reasons I was actually confused by the paradox of beneficial retirement is that the economics, the labor economics of it, didn't make sense to me. So it seems like this paradox exists only when there's a certain kind of market failure. And maybe there is this kind of market failure in various markets. And I think that there is for sure, say, like in the market for professional academics, partly because of the tenure system. But if you're in a area where people's where sort of compensation is a function of productivity, for example, in different sort of productivity will be measured differently in different professions. It will be measured differently for a lawyer than it will be for a doctor. You're trying to produce different outcomes. If we were actually correctly identifying, if the market mechanism was correctly identifying the productivity of various people at various jobs, then this problem would sort itself out. The least productive workers would sort of be pushed out of the labor pool. There wouldn't be a question of their needing to volunteer to retire. I think the fact that that doesn't actually happen, that all sorts of firms are in fact clotted up with semi-competent upper and middle management, actually tells us something about the inefficiency of those markets. That that in fact people's compensation isn't a function of their productivity necessarily. And in that kind of condition, I think your paradox does kick into effect.
Right.
And so I think that's actually one of the useful things about thinking through the paradox is that. It helps us identify something interesting about the world, which in this case is like I think you can use the paradox of beneficial retirement as a kind of heuristic. If you look at a particular firm or at a particular industry and you see that this paradox actually applies,
right,
then I think there's something wrong with that labor market.
Right, Right, I see. Right, yeah, I agree. It's certainly contingent whether it applies, but I think it applies quite a lot. And therefore...
Because imagine... Mm-hmm. I mean, I wanted to give a clear example of... I mean, so think about the pool of professional basketball players, right? There is no paradox of beneficial retirement, right? Like, there's not a question about an over-the-hill player mm-hmm. that's keeping, you know, that's filling a spot that a better player would fill. There's no question whatsoever. Once right. that player becomes less good, they mm-hmm. get cut from the team, right?
You're probably right.
So there's no paradox in that sort of. And I think in lots of different other industries, it's the same thing. Like in a lot of sales positions, there's not going to be a paradox that if you don't meet your sales quota, you simply aren't going to keep up. You're just not going to have a job. So in really competitive areas, there's not going to be a paradox. In mm-hmm. areas where there's sort of licensing that protects incumbents, I think you're going to see a lot of this, and that's interesting.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah. I mean, I think I basically agree. But there is there's another twist here. I mean, I think that sometimes there might be good reasons on a systematic way. I mean, for the system, for the organization, even for a company, not to follow the argument. I mean, not to chuck people out whenever there's somebody better on the outside. But this nevertheless doesn't. So they'll have what you're calling inefficient arrangements, but which might make sense in a broader way for that company. I mean, either for reasons of getting along with the unions or for reasons of, mm-hmm. it might be that you can retain your workforce better in that way, or there might be pragmatic reasons for the company to do that. Mm-hmm. Nevertheless, in a company or certainly in other sorts of organizations, public organizations, nevertheless, my argument might still apply. So it might be mm-hmm. that the organization doesn't throw you out, because that's, and perhaps even that's the best way for organizations to operate. But nevertheless, it seems to me that if what you do matters, I mean, if you just work in McDonald's, then it doesn't matter. But if you, I mean, whether somebody replaces you or not, but if you do something that's really important, and it might be a hospital, or it might be a politician, you might be able to stay in office, but if you come to think, probably that's not a good idea. Politicians would never think that somebody would make their job better, do their job better. But anyway, if you come to think that there is a replacement there that is very likely to do whatever you're doing better, then even if the system doesn't throw you out, you might need to throw yourself out just because of the argument from integrity. And that makes it even more striking.
Yeah, well, I hope, but as you mentioned in your book, I mean, people are systematically biased in their own favor when it comes to right. assessing their own, efficacy. So, everybody thinks that they're above average. So it seems like one of the impediments to people recognizing that they ought to clear out and make space for somebody more effective is the fact that none of us actually thinks that we're worse than average. We all think that we're better than average, and that everything would be worse without us. And so, before people could actually take action, on the basis of their integrity, that I take pride in myself as a good philosopher, and that now that I'm, sort of flagging in my abilities, I should just make space. Well, I'd have to be able to identify the fact that I'm, not the best anymore. And people seem to be very, very bad at accurately assessing their own abilities.
Right. But there are, I mean, again, it depends. But there are, in certain areas, there's certainly a lot of information. I mean, again, I quote in the chapter on this paradox of beneficial retirement in my book, I quote a well-known surgeon who talks about this issue. And it seems that, I mean, makes sense, I guess, that in surgery, you actually know. I mean, some people have the percentage of their patients that die is much lower than others. So you actually mm-hmm. know that you're killing off more patients than it's likely that your replacement will do. And that, I mean, certainly makes the argument for integrity quite salient.
Yeah, one could only wish that those records were available to the general public before they before they pick a surgeon. Actually, this is reminding me, and we can move on to another paradox for me.
Sure.
The issue of sort of promotion and moving up into a slot that's emptying out actually is making me think of your paradox as having to do with choice egalitarianism, partly because so there's this question of inequality and luck, right? Some people mm-hmm. Have more than others as just due to fortune, because of things that are completely outside of their control. And one of the ways in which I think I'm lucky, for instance, is has to do with this job thing. I'm in the Gen X generation, and my cohort is very small relative to the baby boom generation right above us. So when the baby boom generation starts retiring en masse, there's going to be actually a smaller pool of sort of, you know, senior, you know, employees, right? Like when I'm about 45, about everybody my age is all of a sudden going to get a huge promotion because the entire pool of employees in front of them is going to get wiped out, and there's going to be scarcity of sort of people our age. Now, if I were all of a sudden get a promotion to become a vice president at the Cato Institute simply because everybody retired, that would just be good luck. I don't deserve that, right? And so a lot of egalitarians think that, well, look, one of the things that we ought to be thinking about is trying to adjust for a fair society is one in which just losses or gains due to fortune aren't really merited. And so we ought to try to correct for those things. But people do choose some things, right? I could have chosen to be a lawyer and make a lot more money, right? But I chose not to be a lawyer and make a lot, you know. So the fact that I'm not making as much as I could, we don't need to compensate me for that, because that was within my power. But people who never had the opportunity, some people who grew up in impoverished circumstances, if that's just bad luck that they were never able to get the, you know, education that they would need to be a lawyer. So we need to compensate them for their misfortune. And you bring up the fact that there's a real paradox in this way of dealing with sort of luck egalitarianism. And so I talk too much about it. Maybe you can say something about it.
Yeah. Well, basically, there's this position called luck egalitarianism, or choice egalitarianism, as I prefer to call it. And the basic principle of that is that we need to correct for brute luck. I mean, as you say, not the sort of luck that you choose. I mean, if you have some money and you choose to spend it all on the lottery and you lose, then it's your fault. But if you happen to be grievously ill at no fault of yourself, of your own, I mean, you didn't smoke and whatever, but you're still very ill, and you need to spend all your money in trying to get healthy, then that's not your fault and you need to be compensated. So they're trying to compensate for the right things, the things that are not chosen, the sort of bad things that happen to you that are not your fault. And so the basic principle is that nobody should be worse off than somebody else unless it's his fault, unless it's the fact that he's worse off than somebody else is due to his own choices. And that seems, I mean, if you're an egalitarian, that seems like a fairly strong position, a very convincing position, and it's been shown to be much more convincing than Rawls, for example. So that, in a way, that's the dominant egalitarian position. And my argument is a reductio argument. I reductio ad absurdum. I try to show that if you follow that, although it seems sensible if you're an egalitarian, but actually this position leads to something crazy. And the basic move is quite simple. I mean, there's all these technical niceties, but the basic idea is this, that if you are non-effective, what I call a non-effective, and that's somebody who, at no fault of his own, cannot earn anything significant because he's severely handicapped or has other sort of deficiencies. And in other words, nobody's in the open market, nobody's going to pay him anything because nobody needs his services. That person, the non-effective, if we follow the logic of choice egalitarianism or luck egalitarianism, needs to be indexed to Bill Gates, or now I think it's actually Warren Buffett. I mean, the wealthiest person around. And as you can see, that's a clear reductio. And the logic beyond that, behind that is that there's no justification based upon the choices of the non-effectives why they have less money than Bill Gates or Warren Buffett. Because clearly it's not their own fault. It's not due to their own choices because, by definition, a non-effective is somebody who any choices he makes are ineffective. They don't matter to where he ends up being. So we, according to luck egalitarianism, we don't have a story which justifies why any of those non-effective people has less money than Bill Gates, because the only story that there could be is dependent upon their choices, and clearly those sort of people don't have choices. So because they seem not to have thought about that possibility, and once you think about it, that makes the whole position seems crazy, because I mean the idea of non-effective will be on his yacht drinking champagne, etc. And the important thing is that, of course, the effective people, we'll have to pay for
one thing.
Sorry.
Yeah, there wouldn't be enough. But hey, let me try to defend the position. And by defending it, I think I'll show another problem with it. Partly because it gets us into the a very deep sort of epistemological question, which shows the sort of impracticability of this view. But my understanding of the sort of like Dworkin style view that is that each one of the people that you're calling a non-effective, their inability to be effective is a matter of luck. What we need to compensate them for is the difference between what they're getting and what they would have gotten had they not suffered this misfortune. Of course, not everybody who's an ineffective ever could have been as successful as Bill Gates, right? So a lot of the non-effectives are people who at their full potential might have been mailmen or checkout clerks at the supermarket. So instead of making nothing on the market, they would have been making maybe $30,000 a year. So the luck egalitarian says we should be giving them $30,000 a year, which is what they would have gotten had they been able to exercise their potential and ability. We shouldn't be giving them what Bill Gates has simply because we don't know how effective they could be. But of course, this brings up the problem. How would we know what each of these people's sort of maximum earning potential would be given sort of normal circumstances in which they don't suffer misfortunes?
I think actually the things are even more problematic. I mean, I think that the choice egalitarianism or luck egalitarianism is actually committed to giving them what Bill Gates has.
Explain that, because I don't follow why they have to give them what Bill Gates has rather than what they would have had they not suffered misfortune.
Well, I mean, we can dispute this, but we can argue about it. But it seems to me that the basic idea of the position is that the only justification that we have for why somebody has less than Bill Gates is that it's due to his choice. And the fact that and there's no such explanation in the case of the non-effectives, so they're just, they're stuck at the baseline. The moral baseline is, it's a very high baseline, but the moral baseline is Bill Gates. And then we need to give an account why somebody doesn't have as much as Bill Gates if you're an egalitarian. And you and I don't have as much for 200,000 reasons, but among them, as you said, we could have had certainly more. We could have tried. We could have become lawyers, and then we could have tried investing the money like Warren Buffett did, but we didn't even bother to do that. So there's a good, there's a plausible explanation, a convincing moral explanation why you and I are slightly less rich than Bill Gates. But there is no sort of explanation why those non-effectives don't have as much as Bill Gates, because they couldn't have made any relevant choices. So I think that the position is committed to saying that they're actually stuck at that very high baseline, and they have to, they're stuck drinking champagne with Bill Gates on his yacht or whatever it is. I mean, it's interesting also to compare here. I mean, being a non-effective is normally, of course, a misfortune, but it ends up being a pretty good fortune, according to my argument. But of course, the argument really shouldn't go through. It's a reductive argument. It just shows that there's something problematic about egalitarianism.
I still want to argue. I mean, I am a big opponent of this sort of luck egalitarianism. But I'm not sure that your argument's quite fair to it still, because Bill Gates has what he has, right? We were largely due to luck. Right, so part of the idea is that Bill Gates doesn't deserve what he has because of his good fortune. He just happened to be – I mean, he deserves some of it, but to a large extent, he was in the right place at the right time. Somebody was going to occupy that position, and it turned out to be Bill Gates. And somebody else might not have earned as much as he's earned, but a lot of it has to do with timing. A lot of it has to do with just placement. So so Bill Gates, it can't be the baseline, partly because Bill Gates' fortune is a matter of good luck. If you take away his good luck, then he's going to be, you know, converge toward the median. And it seems like what you could do is just say, you know, just, you know, take the law of large numbers and sort of just assume that good luck is sort of washing out bad luck, and that, you know, if good luck and bad luck are sort of averaging out, then the median income is basically what we would expect people to have. And so in cases of non-effectives, what we should be giving them is simply the median income, you know, because maybe they could have been an NBA superstar who would have earned $10 million a year, but we have no way of knowing that. So in the absence of that knowledge, I think the luck egalitarian can plausibly just say that we ought to be giving people who suffered misfortune something like the median income, not what Bill Gates got because of his tremendous good luck.
Yeah. Well, I think that it would be a problem for the position because, I mean, what you're basically saying is we should put the baseline in the middle and then somebody could fall below it if you're just lazy and you don't care to do any work, or you could go above it if you work really hard. But if you're non-effective, then you are on the baseline, sort of in the middle. But that means that there will be people. I mean, we don't even have to go for Bill Gates. I mean, there will be people who will just, you know, do extra shifts, extra work, extra time, and they'll be wealthier than the non-effectives, while the non-effectives had no choice in the matter. And if they had no choice in the matter, then it's just illegitimate in terms of choice egalitarianism. So I would try to resist your kind of move.
All right, let's move on to one more paradox real quickly, which is the paradox of complaint.
Right.
So say I'm a terrorist who was planning on blowing up a million people. I had a suitcase nuke and I was going into a huge metropolis planning to blow it up. I was caught, but my conspirators are still at large, and so the authorities decide to torture me. Do I have a right to complain?
Right. Well, there's of course a huge issue. The question of ticking bombs and torturing terrorists, etc., is of course a huge issue. But the paradox that I've thought about, I think has some input here. I mean, this is one of those paradoxes that I don't know where it's going, and it's still very much in the air. But I'll explain why I think that it's relevant even to cases of terrorism. I mean, let's start with an easier case. Let's think about somebody who's a car thief. I mean, suppose you make your living by stealing cars, and you've been doing this for 15 years, and it's wonderful. You're making a good living. You've bought a few. On your proceeds, you've bought a few cars of your own, and then it turns out that somebody has stolen your favorite car. Now, of course, you're allowed to, it makes sense for you to be really angry, but the question is, can you complain morally? And it seems to me that there's a strong argument for saying that you can't, because basically, how can you expect, you can't morally expect people not to steal cars when that's what you do regularly. And you don't have. How can you be moral? How can there be moral indignation on your part at what somebody has done to you when that's the thing that you normally, as a rule, do to everybody else? So, and also, I don't think that you can expect us to take your grievance seriously. I mean, you can't really resent this, and you can't expect us to take it seriously, because, after all, that's the way you, as Kant would say, I mean, that's the way you have legislated. You have legislated that it's legitimate to steal cars. So now when your car is stolen, you can't complain. I think that seems quite plausible in this case. But then, what's the difference between this case and the terrorist? So if you kill the relatives, I mean, there's an active terrorist who's killed people, and then you turn on and kill his innocent relatives, then of course it's wrong to kill the innocent relatives, but can he complain morally? And it's problematic to say that he can complain because, after all, he's a terrorist. And then if we turn to torture, then that seems like even an easier case because, first of all, he's not innocent, unlike his relatives. I mean, he is a terrorist. And secondly, we're not even killing him. We're just torturing him. So it seems that it's really problematic to say that he can complain. On the other hand, there's all those other deep intuitions we have that about moral human rights, etc., and that it seems that some things are just forbidden. It's just wrong. It might be wrong to torture people. And in that case, he has a reason for complaint. But I don't want to confuse this with the issue of are we permitted to torture
right.
terrorists or not in these very sticky conditions. Assume that we just, think about a situation where, just the prison guards are bored. There's nothing on TV. So they're just torturing him just for the fun. And that's clearly wrong. It's clearly illegitimate of them to do this. But then, nevertheless, we can come and ask, can he complain? Well, he's done much worse things, so how can he complain? And so this seems to be this antinomy, this two contradictory arguments, one saying that it's ridiculous, clearly he can't complain, and also obviously he can complain because he has been wronged. And then I try out this compromise position here, but the problem is that it's not much of a solution. It's almost as paradoxical as the problem. But anyway, the thing I've thought about is that what we might want to do is we might want to separate constraint from complaint. We might want to keep the constraint and say we are not allowed to torture people, certainly not just for the fun of it. But in this context, if we're talking about a terrorist, then he cannot complain. But that's a really weird view. If that's the conclusion we end up with, it's so strange. I don't know what to do. It's sort of crazy because it means that, at least usually we think that if somebody has been wronged, then clearly it's almost analytic. If somebody has been wronged, then clearly he can complain. But then we recall that he actually did that sort of thing himself, so arguably perhaps he can't complain.
Yeah, so the kind of the question is, as a general rule, if wronged, you have a right of indignation. There's also a general rule that if you wrong someone in a particular way and then you're wronged in that way, mm-hmm. you don't have a right of indignation.
Right.
And so those two principles can come into conflict. And it does just seem paradoxical to me that you're right, that on the one hand, clearly, if I've stolen, if I make my living stealing cars, the first general principle, allows me to be indignant for having my car stolen. The mm-hmm. second says that I shouldn't be indignant, or at least that maybe it's a different principle than that, simply that other people don't have reason to take my indignation seriously. Maybe right. that's what the principle is. And in which case, that wouldn't necessarily be paradoxical. It's just that that I have a right to complain according to this general principle, but other people have a right to ignore my complaint according to the other general principle.
Maybe, but I'm not sure I would want to give up so easily on that. I actually think that there's something completely ridiculous about the idea of you complaining about your car being, of course you can say, oh, I really love the car, but it's like complaining about having a headache. But if you're full of moral indignation or resentment, or you think that you can expect that nobody will steal cars, then I don't see how that follows. If you steal cars, it's like don't do unto others as you don't want them to do unto you. But if you do unto others a certain way, then you can't complain if they do so to onto you.
Yeah, think of this example, which has happened to me. So suppose I live in a house that's divided into apartments. There's a first floor apartment and a second floor apartment. Mm-hmm. And the guy in the second floor apartment plays his music really, really, really loud.
Right.
Right? And it bothers us on the first floor apartment. Well, we like to play our music really, really, really loud as well. Right. And so we go upstairs to complain about the guy's really loud music. And of course, he could complain to us about our loud music as well. Mm-hmm. But knowing that he also plays really loud music that probably bothers us, he does complain to himself, but he thinks that he's not licensed to complain to us because we have a similar grounds for complaint. And that does seem like plausible to me, that just the issue is whether or not you think that you have, you do complain, you feel justified in complaining, but you feel like the other people don't have reason to take your complaint seriously, so you don't complain to them. I do think that there's a resolution in that direction.
Right. Well, I don't know. I have a number of other paradoxes left, so if you ruin one of them, that's okay. But I would still want to struggle a bit. I mean, I think that there's something that, I mean, of course you can voice a complaint. You can complain to others, and maybe they'll listen to you, even though you've played music, loud music. So, you know, it might be effective to do it. And, you might not notice, or you might not care about logic, or so you might complain. But I think that if we look at it deeply, then morally, your case is just gone. I mean, if this is the sort of thing that you do regularly, knowing what it means to do it, and you can't complain if people behave in the same way, because that's the sort of thing that you did. You've legislated, again, in Kantian terms, that's okay to do. It's okay to do it, so you can't complain morally. It's not a matter just that nobody needs to take you seriously. I mean, of course, they'll also find you ridiculous and not take you seriously, but in a deeper way, I think, there's just no case. You've dropped the case from under your feet.
Well, we're a little bit over our time, Saul, so we should wrap it up. So let me, at the end, just ask you about what you're on to next. So tell us a little bit about what's after Paradox and what you mean by crazy ethics.
Right. Well, I think it'll be pretty simple to explain in a broad sense, because in a general way, because it sort of comes out of my previous work. I mean, we haven't had time to talk about my free will views, but there's general agreement in the free will community that they're pretty crazy. And also the paradoxes. I mean, I tend to think of the paradoxes as sort of black holes in our moral universe, where really weird things, crazy things happen. And now, what makes an ethical view crazy? I mean, I want to clarify that I'm certainly not talking about the idea that, you know, your views are crazy, my views are okay. No, that's
right.
Easy. I mean that our views, I mean, the best views we have, the views that we have reason to think might well be true, I think that there might also be crazy. And what does the craziness, what could it involve? Well, one thing I think that makes a view crazy is the idea that it's self-defeating, that if you have an ethical position, and if you try to implement it, then it would be worse in terms of that very ethical position. And Derek Parfit has written about that. And I'm now working on a paper on hard determinism, where I think that hard determinism might, at least in part, I mean, it might be true, but even if it's true, we can't live according to it. We can't implement it. So even hard determinists shouldn't want hard determinism to be implemented. And that seemed, it's an interesting question whether it could still be true, but nevertheless couldn't be applied in any way. That's an interesting metaphysical, philosophical question. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so that's one thing that could make for a crazy view, that you just couldn't apply it. Another thing is, I mean, go back to the paradox of beneficial retirement. The conclusion seemed pretty crazy to me. I mean, it's so over-demanding to ask a person in that situation to retire while nobody else is going to do anything proportional to that. But nevertheless, there's that argument from retirement. So let's think that actually he should retire, but it's just over-demanding, realistically, to expect anybody to do that. I'm not sure that that's the right conclusion. I think that some people might actually retire. But even if we assume that nobody will retire, that still would that make the case, that would that make the argument not true? No, it would still be true. It would just be over-demanding. And if we think about an ethics that is consistently demands things of people that nobody feels that they can live up to, then that seems pretty crazy to me as well. And there are other things that might make views crazy. One other example is the idea of an esoteric morality. I mean, the idea of an ethics that you can't actually tell people about. If you tell people about it, then it would make things worse. Anyway, that's the sort of thing I've been working on, and the moral paradoxes are important for me because they're not really vague and general ideas like that a lot of people will argue against, like hard determinism or utilitarianism, for example, which might well be over-demanding, but a lot of people would just not agree with it. I think the paradox, it's more difficult to resist the paradoxes, or at least it's hard to resist all of them. But if there are indeed specific instances of this sort of craziness that I'm talking about, then we might have to agree that we'd have no choice but to agree that certain corners of morality are crazy. And that, I mean, that has a lot of implications. I probably don't have time to go into all that, but just in a few words, I think it probably means that we have to give up the hope of having a fully consistent and coherent ethical view, because there are these black holes peppered around in our moral universe, and they just make things pretty crazy.
Well, that actually sounds plausible to me, especially if you think about our moral intuitions, being a joint product of our sort of evolutionary history and our cultural history. There's no real reason why you might expect all of those intuitions to line up and to form a coherent set of convictions. Yeah. So maybe one of the deeper explanations of sort of the paradox is that our sort of moral sense isn't built in some way, either by nature or nurture, to generate a coherent morality.
Right.
And then we have to find something else, I guess.
Right, right. But, I mean, the interesting thing for me is that, I mean, nobody has trouble thinking about physics. Modern physics is crazy. I mean, string theory and quantum mechanics and all these funny things, I mean, they seem really odd. But we tend to think about morality as though, we're still in biblical times or something. And morality, we think, is just really simple. At least a lot of people think about it that way. And even philosophers have tended to neglect moral paradoxes. I mean, it's quite amazing. The paradoxes, per se, are really important in philosophy and logic and epistemology and metaphysics, even in philosophy of science. They're really a big deal. I mean, there's just scores of books and articles coming up all the time. But the moral paradoxes have been really neglected. And I think that on some level, we're really afraid to tackle these sores and to try to look what's going on there, because it's really frightening. It threatens the idea. Morality seems somehow something that we should try to maintain and take care of. And we just don't want to look too closely at what's looking on, lurking around there.
Well, I think that's our time, Saul. But you've made a great start on the investigation of moral paradoxes. Your book is both an easy read and incredibly stimulating. So thanks so much for coming on. The book is 10 Moral Paradoxes, and there's at least 6 more that we didn't cover. So please check out the book. Thanks so much for coming on, Saul.
Thank you very much.
Take care now.